This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
He deserves to be free because journalism isn't a crime. War crimes are a crime. And the truth is the beginning to fighting war.
Protesters mark the third anniversary of the imprisonment of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange.
Teachers, talk to your teachers. Tell them let's strike for how long it's going to take. Let's strike for how long it's going to take.
Teachers and longshore workers are set to strike in Oakland, California, against privatization of schools and gentrification.
On April 7, I attended a press conference at Ethiopia's University of Gondar, where researchers presented their findings about mass graves and underground prisons created to dominate and destroy Amhara people who had lived there prior to the TPLF occupation.
And COVID, Race, and Democracy, and Garrison reports from Ethiopia. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. On Monday, April 11th, demonstrations were held around the world on the third year anniversary of the incarceration of journalist and publisher Julian Assange in the UK high security Belmarsh prison. A rally was held at the US Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., and one of the speakers, independent journalist Fiorella Isabel, talked about the political implications for journalists of the possible extradition of Australian citizen Julian Assange to the U.S. for espionage.
We all know it's been 3 years since Julian Assange has been in the Guantanamo Bay of the United Kingdom, Belmarsh Prison. And in those 3 years, we have seen the surveillance powers of this corporatist existence of an empire expand. We've seen the powers of corporations and the national security state apparatus take control and take away rights, liberties, and freedoms from the American people that we will never get back. We can look back to 9/11 and look back to what was taken away from us. Did we get any of that back once supposed threats were subsided? We will never get any of it back. And that's the thing they don't tell you, is once you lose these civil liberties and these civil rights, you never get them back. And so we can look back to what's happened the last 3 years since 2019, since April 11th of 2019. 3 years ago, we had an election where many people questioned the election, where many supporters of Bernie Sanders thought, what the hell happened? The guy who was in fifth place became the president of the United States, and the woman who couldn't win a single delegate, Kamala Harris, became the vice president with one phone call from Barack Obama. Subsequently, of course, we had January 6th, where the mainstream media took that incident and called it an insurrection and an attempted coup. Rich of the United States to talk about coups when they go all over the world, overturning legitimate democracies and completely ignoring the choices of those people of these democracies. In 2014, Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt started giving out cookies and went to Ukraine, trying to subvert a democracy. They wanted Yanukovych out, and they wanted to put in their puppet, and they did, and they were able to do that. But nobody talks about those 8 years ago when all of this happened. They say this is only Putin's war, that NATO and the United States have nothing to do with it, which is entirely false, because there is a phone call, an audio that all of you can listen to, where Victoria Nuland purports as to how she wants Yanukovych removed. And 14,000 people died, 14,000 ethnic Russians and Slavics and people of the Romani origin. Nobody talks about those dead children, those bodies that the US media ignored up until, of course, this very conflict that we find ourselves in. And make no mistake, of course, there are innocent people on Ukrainian side and on the Russian side, but let's not pretend that the United States isn't an empire with over 1,000 military bases all over the world. And you can compare that to China or to Russia or to any existing empire, because you can't. So when people compare those two, they are lacking an understanding as to what it is that we're living in today. This is Western imperialism. This is Western hegemony. And right now, what we're seeing is a shift into a multipolar world, a pushback from the East and the global South. I was in Nicaragua recently, and I got to experience what fair and free elections are. Elections where they publicly count the ballots, where people love their government, and they are so excited to support their leader. Yet, we call Daniel Ortega a dictator, just like we call the people in Cuba, the government in Cuba, dictators. We say that about Iran. We say that about any country that we consider an enemy. Yet, look at the people we have in power. Look at what happened in 2020 in the pandemic world, where these countries responded so much better than this first world nation. When they were able to be more honest and open, where they were able to have debates. In the United States, we vilified each other. We divided each other. That's what these people did. These 1% global capitalist elites are trying to pit us against each other. And the reality is, we need actual media, like Julian, to expose that. And we have very few of us left. Because what happens is we get censored, we get sneered, we get vilified to no end. We get told we're Putin puppets. We get told that we're paid by the Assad regime. We get completely ostracized. And we need to push back against that. I am here today because of Julian Assange, because he released WikiLeaks and he inspired me and many others to take it upon themselves to be the truth tellers, to be the ones who scream off the tops of their lungs that this is the Department of Injustice, not the Department of Justice. There is no justice here today in this moment. We don't live in a democracy. We don't even live in a republic. We live in an oligarchy. The United States is a military corporatist state with a film production crew ready and willing to create propaganda for narrative managers and puppets to continue promoting what must be said. And that is the reality we live in. And the more people understand it, the better it'll be for the rest of us. And so I tell all of you who are out here today, you are brave just for showing up, because we will get mobbed, and you probably do. Oh, look at you bringing up Julian Assange. He's just a guy. He's a traitor, just like somebody just walked by and said. He's not important. They don't even know he's not even an American. He's an Australian publisher. And he's the reason why I learned about the collateral murder videos. He is the reason why there was so much pushback in the progressive movement in 2016 when Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party worked together to subvert Bernie Sanders' run as for president. And that is why I'm an election integrity activist. That is why I care about foreign policy. That is why I'm an anti-imperialist. It is because of inspirations like Julian, and he deserves to be here with his family. He deserves to be free, because journalism isn't a crime. War crimes are a crime, and the truth is the beginning to fighting war. Thank you very much.
Journalist and activist Fiorella Isabel speaking at a rally on April 11th in Washington, D.C. That was Azadi by Divine. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Next, we'll hear from COVID Race and Democracy's Anne Garrison on the ground in Ethiopia.
U.S. officialdom and both state and corporate media in the U.S. have described the Ethiopian conflict that began in November 2020 as the Ethiopian government's persecution of the Tigrayan people, particularly in what they call, quote, Western Tigray, unquote, though it was historically populated and cultivated by Amhara people. This land, encompassing Olkait, Tigiri, Tselemt, and Humera, was methodically annexed to the Tigray region by the U.S.'s longtime ally, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, during their three decades in power. On April 7, I attended a press conference at Ethiopia's University of Gondar, where researchers presented their findings about mass graves and underground prisons created to dominate and destroy Amhara people who had lived there prior to the TPLF occupation. 10 days later, on Easter, I spoke to Sheba Tekeste, who joined photographer Jamal Countess to travel through some of the canyons and cliffs where the mass graves and prisons were uncovered. We spoke in the lobby of the Goha Hotel in Addis Ababa while a thunderstorm was underway outside. Sheba, tell us about your trip into Wakait from the University of Gondar with Jamal Countess.
It was way beyond what I expected. I mean, I expected to see some of the findings that we'd already seen some TV clips of, with, you know, the digging of bones and mass graves and such. But I guess actually walking through the rough terrain and climbing up cliffs and sides of mountains and the excruciating process and getting to these places, and then also hearing the stories from the people who were guiding us, was overwhelming. Dejana, which was the first location that we went to, where they showed us some of the torture camps and the cliffs at Minminne, where Wolkait residents during the time before TPLF actually took power in Addis were taken to be forced to denounce their ethnicity and thrown off cliffs if they did not, and these kind of things. Looking at these places as the stories are being told was overwhelming. It was very emotional. And what was really, really outrageous to me was that there was multiple places that existed with similar stories. And pretty much anywhere we went, even in the path to the worst of the prison camps, which was called Gahannam, people were pointing to places where there's graves, literally in the entire track through, and I think that was over 80 to 100 kilometers in length of cities or towns, small towns. There was just trails of this story, so it was a lot.
Explain what you mean by giving up their ethnic identity. People were executed or thrown off cliffs, tortured, if they weren't willing to give up their ethnic identity. Can you explain what that means and how they were asked to give it up?
So one of the specific stories that we were told, and this was from several accounts, several people were telling us these similar stories, was that the primary targets for these types of killings and torture were elders, mostly men, teachers, historians, and landowners, and basically those who can tell the cultural history of Wolkait and the people and their culture, because the objective was to eliminate their entire identity and to replace it with a new identity and force the people to accept that they are now Tigrayan. It was told to us in that graphic form, like, you are Tigrayan, and if you are not accepting of this, then you get thrown off the side of the cliff and killed. And at first, when they said concentration camps, I expected to see prisons. And what we saw were holes in the ground, which were lined up by stone, which looked like walls to like different cells of a prison, which were really narrow and deep. And the way they described it, there would be ladders thrown down and then people would be brought up. So it was almost like a torture camps where they would try to break you. You would be kept in there and you would be tortured. They would pluck people's nails off. There was descriptions of like these worms that were in this, you know, inside of these caves that would go into your skin. You would be taken out and beat. and then put back and then taken out again. And it was more of a breaking process until you would accept the authority of the Azaj, as they call them, which means, the translation of which means the authority or the commanders, which was a TPLF at the time.
And then you would be asked to take it to Grinya name and to speak to Grinya from then on?
I didn't hear that specifically, but it was if you were speaking in Amharic or if you said, I'm Walkait or I'm Ethiopian. You know, one of the gentlemen, Abba Fatanu Gabriye, who was imprisoned for 11 years in total at different time frames, clearly described that he would be asked to join the liberation of Tigray and the movement, and that he was one with them. And he said, I'm Ethiopian, and why would I do that? What does this have to do with me? And I'm from Walkait, and I'm, you know, Amhara. And that was one of the reasons he was imprisoned. And all of this corresponds with the other stories from the gentleman who showed us his where he was imprisoned for a year and 7 months in Dejana. And he said that they would take people out and take them to the side of the cliffs and threaten them that if they did not accept that they are Tigrayan and to speak in Tigrinya, if they held on to their Amhara ethnic identity or they said anything otherwise, then they would be thrown off. So, for instance, he described 74 people that he knew personally that were in and out of that specific torture hole that he was in for the year and 7 months. And out of the 74 people, 32 made it alive. The remaining 42 died. So my assumption, again, based on the stories we were told, is those who did not say, okay, I accept that I am this, they were thrown off and they were killed and never heard of again.
And how safe was he talking about this now, now that there's a new administration and for now the TPLF is gone, but this is a large subject, conceivably inflammatory subject, so how safe was he talking about it?
He was more than eager, and there was people lining up, like, to speak. They were relieved to finally be able to talk. So there was this bursting need and energy to speak, to finally break their silence, which was very clear to me. They were spelling out their name so I could get it right. So I don't know if that tells you something, but for me it said they wanted this on record.
Do you think there's a way to study and commemorate this and make it part of the national dialogue, perhaps broadly speaking, in which it would serve to move beyond ethnicity towards an Ethiopian identity rather than further exacerbating ethnic conflict?
I think that's a great question. I think that even in speaking to people in Addis about other stories where people, regardless of their ethnic group, when they opposed something, were outright like opposing something from TPLF leadership, they were disappeared. They were killed. This whole break the silence theme should be part of this national dialogue. And I think when you start hearing some stories that other people would come forward, and this would really make a change because it'll actually show that it wasn't just ethnically charged, it was just extreme authoritarianism of some form where people were just extremely afraid and kept things to themselves, and there was many, many, many victims of TPLF, and not just Walkait. I think the Walkait story just breaks it open.
What about the issue of whether Walkait and these other areas that the TPLF annexed during their rule and called Western Tigray, what about the possession of this area now? Is there a way to get beyond the issue of whether it belongs to Amhara or whether it belongs to Tigray?
I don't think that, if we're going to be honest, that we could ever say that those areas belonged to Tigray. First, I think, in my opinion, the first thing we have to recognize is all of these things that we're talking about are a part of Ethiopia, period. Let's start there. And then when you talk about these borders that were created after 91 as a part of the TPLF's start of power, you have to go into the history of the, you know, the region and the people and, you know, north and south of the Tekeze River is just a well-known thing, historical fact, that the Amharas lived south and the Tegarus lived north. It's just part of record. It's part of our history. And then I also want to say, you know, Amharas and Tegarus are just clans or groups of people who are all part of the same national background for centuries, mm-hmm. and that coexisted. Mm-hmm. And it should, you know, it's troubling that we're at the point, we can't deny it, but we're at the point where we're recognizing regions by ethnic groups. And this is part of what TPLF created, just simply creating regions, and not just ethnically, but by language specifically. It's troubling because that's kind of in the fabric of the way people identify themselves now and recognize regions. But before, there was no such thing as this region and that region. You just, you know, actually specified the town or the city that you were from. And you may be a speaker of this language or that language, but that was never a critical part of anything political. For instance, nobody in the past, to my knowledge, would ever say, I'm from the Amhara region. They would say, I'm from Gondar. And Tigray was just like that, I'm from Tigray. And you speak Tigrinya, but there's other places that you speak Tigrinya as well. And it was never divided in this way until the TPLF.
Would the proposed changes to the constitution eliminate the ethnic identification of regions, Tigray, Amhara, Oromia, etc.?
It absolutely should. It absolutely should. If it doesn't do that, then what is it for? Like, that's the first objective. They should be the first objective. They want to save lives. That's where they start, is completely revamping this whole language, ethnic-based politics. It should be about people's rights and nativity and what they need to survive, and not about, you know, I speak this language, so I have this land, and whatever the case, you know, because absolutely, I mean, it should, and that should be primary objective.
Okay, Sheba Tekesta, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate it.
That was COVID, Race, and Democracy's Anne Garrison on the ground in Ethiopia. That was music by Ethiopian artist Teddy Efro. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The recent attack on New York's MTA fortunately led to no deaths, but it showed again the dangerous health and safety conditions for workers and the public. Pacifica's Steve Zelter spoke with two MTA TW100 transit operators, Anthony Steininger and John Ferretti. They're also members of Fight Back, a caucus in their union local about the social conditions, health and safety, and the massive corruption of New York politicians.
My experience that day was I was on my way to work, and I usually get on the train, the D train, which stops at 36th Street, around about 9:15 sometime in Manhattan. Trains were being rerouted. And I looked on the MTA app that I have on my phone, and it said that there was some sort of investigation at 36th Street. It didn't say what it was, didn't say, you know, exactly what had happened. So I spoke to the conductor on the train I was riding, and it was a passenger that informed us via, you know, their cell phone and their you know, the news app that they had, that it was an actual shooting there. The TA, the MTA, was actually at that time, some 30 minutes after the attack, was telling employees that it was a smoke condition, you know, or some sort of FDNY, NYPD investigation. So employees really had no idea that this horrendous attack had occurred. So, by the time I did finally get to 95th Street, I had to take an Uber, which the prices were exorbitant. They price gouged everyone in South Brooklyn that day.
That Uber, it was price surging on a catastrophe, making money on a catastrophe. Yeah. That's Uber.
Yeah, it was $42 to go from 5th Avenue and 9th Street in Brooklyn to 4th Avenue and 95th Street in Brooklyn. It was ridiculous. Fortunately, I spoken to someone who was going in the same direction as I was, and we split the fare. But it was just ridiculous. It was horrendous. All the bus stops were packed. The buses were jam packed with people. You know, as far as management's failure, you know, one of my coworkers remarked earlier today that you know, we spend every year we go to a right to know refresher, where we as train operators and conductors learn about handling hazardous materials, but we're not refreshed on really on handling, you know, something that is like this, which is likely to occur, an emergency situation. You know, we receive that training not as often as we should. The last time I remember going to some sort of training that would actually help us deal with this was several years ago, when it should be, you know, every year, every 2 years at minimum, for train operators, conductors, cleaners, station personnel, anyone that is dealing directly with the public should have proper training on how to deal with an emergency situation. I also want to give all credit to my coworkers on the R train, who that train that pulled up beside that train where this madman was, whose quick thinking possibly could have saved lives. Yeah. And to everyone who was in that station who actually took action to help people evacuate, get away from the area, you know, all those people deserve the utmost, you know, praise and thanks for helping to minimize the damage that happened that day.
And also joining us is John Ferretti. And John, the mayor has said that there's an issue of guns, that's the problem. Who's responsible for this kind of thing? It's a continuing thing. Of attacks on transit, on people in the streets. I mean, it really is getting out of control.
Well, it's been out of control for decades. I mean, to be honest, like transit workers know when they're told a signal en route for police, that just means shut up and suffer in silence. That's what it means. Because the police don't even know the signal. When the signal is supposed to be, was it three? Anthony, it's
one long.
One long, one short.
One short.
Yeah, one long buzzer, one short buzzer is supposed to be a signal to police for police assistance. You can't find a police officer in the New York City area that knows what the hell that means. So it's useless to us. So when rail control, our bosses tell us to signal en route for police, basically they mean keep the train moving and it's your problem, deal with it. And, you know, we've had a long history of transit worker assaults, a long history of transit workers being the Dutch boy with their finger in the dikes, trying to keep things running in this entire system, even during COVID. And, you know, basically, I used to joke to coworkers that we're basically a mobile social service unit without any social services. And that's basically what has been the case for decades. You know, COVID just ripped the gaping wound off of that problem that's been going on in society for a long time. What we have is complete and total social dysfunction. And the reason why we have that is because we don't tax the rich to pay for the services that are really necessary to solve the problems that we face. Problems of issues with mental health, a lack of a punitive approach to everything. The solution for everything is more cops. We spend $10 billion a year as a city on policing, yet their solve rate is like less than 30%. The cops that were on the scene on that day, at 25th Street on that train that they saved all those customers to get them to 25th Street away from the shooting scene. You have injured customers shot. And what is the response of the police officer? Oh, call 911, my radio doesn't work. My radio doesn't work, right? They were going on us. Our faces would be plastered all over the media. These incompetent workers let people die because they didn't follow New York City Transit's rules. So, I mean, look, it's a much bigger problem than just one solution. The cameras in the station didn't work. MTA went out and lied last September. They said they wired every station, all 472 subway stations, to be videotaped 24 hours a day in case just an incident like this happens. Then they got caught with their pants down and they got exposed because none of the cameras worked in the station. And what's the response? Oh, well, those three cameras don't work. So all the other cameras work. All the millions and millions of dollars were spent to wire this with God knows what kind of corrupt contract, but only those three don't work. So, you know, this is an ongoing social collapse that's been going on for a long time. And it's because the ruling class runs society, because the ruling class starves our communities for the things that we need to prevent these kind of tragedies from happening. You got to understand that the Democratic Party is just as corrupt as the Republican Party and is in the pocket of billionaires and has been for decades. Kathy Hochul just passed a $220 billion budget that gives $800 million to a stadium for billionaires in Buffalo. And guess who owns the concessions for the stadium? Her husband. Her daughter is a lobbyist for Big Pharma. She's taken money from every developer in the entire state, takes money from dirty energy companies. You know, so the thing is, like, the Democrats or Republicans, it really doesn't matter because the corruption is the same in terms of that. That hasn't changed for decades.
What's the response to the GW and the unions in New York?
Nothing.
I mean, it's laughable if I'm being kind.
Yeah.
Their response was, so Doris Hochul and all the corruption, by the way. And by the way, her lieutenant governor just got arrested on federal charges for bribery and corruption. So the day before he gets arrested, they go out and endorse her. Great timing, guys. But corruption loves corruption, right? But the response of the union so far has been to engage in a $50,000 reward for getting the perpetrator. And who do they get the $50,000 from? They share the wealth between themselves and the NYPD police fund. So here's a union that gets $35 million a year from our dues. And all they can afford is $25,000. And the only way they want to do it is if they could suck up a little more to the NYPD. And basically what they've done has been nothing but an appendage of Mayor Adams. And Mayor Adams is a sadist. He's a heartless bastard who doesn't care about homeless people. He wants to break up encampments. They're stealing their medicine. They're stealing their personal possessions. And they're just engaging in another form of vicious attack, which is what the cops always do, in the name of solving the crisis. And they're doing it at the behest of Wall Street, because all of the people who are pressuring Adams to break up these encampments, to kick them out of the subways, are all the Grand Central Partnership, all these bougie partnerships to try to further gentrify the city and make the poor unwelcome.
I'm going to bring it back 100 years and talk about, you know, the beginnings of unions. And what we're seeing now is that unions began basically as instruments of social change, you know, and what we have now is just a bureaucracy. And the response that they've had now with this crisis, with the COVID crisis, with the current shooting, with all of the things that are going on, the homeless crisis, has been in service to the ruling class and the billionaire. Transit could be fully funded. We could have homeless services. And when you talked about mental health care, is health care, period. We need a health care system in this country that covers everybody and every health issue, which we don't have. And our union isn't pushing for it. And not many unions are. Not many of your entrenched unions are pushing for that as hard as they can be. When you talk about the Democratic Party, you know, we just endorsed Kathy Hochul. The Democrats have been in power in our state for decades, really. And in Washington, the last presidential election, took control of both the Senate, the House, and the executive branch. And yet we haven't seen any real legislation come forth that would solve these problems. The wealthy should be paying for these services because they're the ones who benefit the most from it. What the opposite is actually occurring on many fronts, where, you know, fares always on the rise. And the TA is always borrowing money from these big banks and institutions. And that money gets paid back through our tax subsidies of mass transit and through our paying fares. And then they want to increase the burden on the workers by making us work longer for less money. Each and every contract time, this is what happens. I've been here 15 years, and this is what happens. So what you're what you're seeing is the slow erosion of what used to be a middle class in this country, because it's happening all over and everywhere. Say one of the more notable places we're seeing where what unionism is supposed to be is with Amazon. And that was from the ground up union organizing. And it was the workers themselves who took it upon themselves to organize and unionize. And our union right now is not that way.
We just heard from Anthony Steininger and John Ferretti, NTA TWU 100 Transit Operators, in conversation with COVID Race and Democracy producer Steve Zeltzer.
Come on, come on. I see no changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor and even worse, I'm black. My stomach hurts, so I'm looking for a purse to snatch. Cops give a damn about a Negro. Pull a trigger, kill him, he's a hero. Get it to the kids, who the hell cares? One less hungry mouth on the welfare. First ship him, don't let him deal with brothers. Give him guns, step back, watch them kill each other. It's time to fight back, that's what Huey said. Two shots in the dark, now Huey's dead. I got love for my brothers, but we can never go nowhere unless we share with each other. We gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two distant strangers. And that's how it's supposed to be. How can the devil take a brother if he's close to me? I let it go back to when we played as kids, but then it changed. That's the way it is. Come on, come on.
That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh yeah.
I want to be the only way I've been practicing my whole life to live my life.
Changes by Tupac. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. In California, the Oakland Education Association Representative Council has voted overwhelmingly to recommend a one-day strike of Oakland public schools against the privatization and closure of public schools on April 29th. The same day that the longshore workers in ILWU Local 10 will stop work at the Port of Oakland. Members of the two unions are both fighting privatization of public resources and gentrification of working-class black and brown communities, driven by the closure of public schools and the plan to build a ballpark and 3,000 condominiums at the Howard Terminal at the Port of Oakland. Moses Omolade, a hunger striker and parent, as well as a Westlake Middle School administrator, spoke on April 13th to the OUSD school board and teachers and students about the need to have the strike with the work action by the ILWU longshore workers. This would be the first united front against privatization by two unions that could expand nationally. It was initiated by the Schools and Labor Against Privatization.
So check this out. Teachers, these people are up here flexing their power. They are flexing their power, and we are coming to them asking.
Next
we have
speaker,
unions
please.
For a reason.
We have unions for a reason. We have unions for a reason. So my ask is, if you pay union fees, and we got power, we got parents, we got students, we got teachers. Flex on them and let's go on a strike. Yeah. You understand what I'm saying? So what I'm hearing is, teachers, we went on a strike because we weren't getting paid enough. Y'all remember that? Why can't we strike to show them where our power is, though? I don't understand it. I really want to speak to that. Keith Brown, you hear him speaking to you, family. Why can't we strike to show them where our power is? Why do we have to write to the judge to ask the judge to help stop this, or we can go on strike tomorrow? Our families support us. We can set up hubs and community centers to take care of families' kids while the teachers are on the streets striking. This is how we gotta handle these folks. April 29th, teachers, if y'all don't make that one day happen, I'm questioning what we're doing. Why are we in the classrooms? We've known for years, state testing is harming our children. But yet we are complying in the harm of our black and brown children by doing these tests. We don't even tell our parents, I'm talking now. I'm talking.
We do not
inform our parents that our children don't have to take the state test. Why don't we do that? So, what I'm saying is, I am talking.
Mr. Malata, can you please put on your mask?
I need you to stop.
Putting your mask? Mr. Malata, please put on your mask.
So, teachers, talk to your families. Right. Let them know in California you can opt out of state testing.
That's right.
They don't need to take those tests. You understand? Teachers, talk to your teachers. Tell them let's strike for how long it's going to take. Let's strike for how long it's going to take.
Mr. Malata, would you please put your mask on?
It's our shit.
Mr. Malata, put your mask on, please. We need to recess the meeting for 5 minutes.
You're shameful, Gary Lee. You're a thief. Sam Davidson took your article offline because you knew you were lying. You had an article online saying it was not good to close schools. And you took it offline, you coward. Why don't you leave it online?
We got pictures.
We got pictures, let them put it online. Come on, go get to the system, yo. Tired of y'all, man. Out here doing all this gathering. Yo, family, we don't need them. We really don't need them. We need to understand that. We are the many. If we decide to go out tomorrow and take all our kids out of these schools, we can do that. Let's stop asking them for things. Let's go on strike. Let's take our babies, let's hit the streets with the teachers for 7-8 days, and let's see what y'all do there. Let's see what y'all do then.
That was Moses Omolade, a NOB school closure hunger striker and parent, as well as a Westlake Middle School administrator, speaking on April 13th to the OUSD school board. You can find more about SLAP, S-L-A-P, at theslapbayarea.org. Music by Gigi from the album Best of Gigi. April is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month and Child Abuse Prevention Month. Bootsy Peters-Mann is creator of WOO, a Houston organization, Women Healing and Empowering Women. She talks about the sexual assault of today in connection with the assault of her ancestors and about the Bea Richards poem, A Black Woman Speaks of White Womanhood, of white supremacy, of peace in 1950, and the influence and the inspiration it had on the organization.
April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. We cannot afford not to think about it because, I mean, it's what built this country. It was built on that. For me, like, I think it's important to use those so-called awareness months and or whatever honors to shine a light on the hypocrisy, because they have April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and then Earth Day is also in the month of April, and this year is April 22nd. And for some years, we've been working on this movement to get some traction around it, to get some resources around for it to do this work called Be a Ripple Sexual Healing Grief Ritual Movement. And it's inspired by poet and ancestor and activist named Bea Richards, spelled B-E-A-H. And she wrote this poem in 1951 titled A Black Woman Speaks of White Womanhood, of White Supremacy, and of Peace. And it's at the root of the work that we're doing to address the fact that at the root of women in incarcerated domestic violence, you know, because we deal with the intersectionality of domestic violence and homelessness. When I say domestic violence, I mean i.e. molestation, rape, and incest. And so when we talk about issues like Sexual Assault Awareness Month and or any kind of awareness when domestic violence and all stuff, they don't address these root issues. So we want to connect the dots and say, okay, well, if you want to talk about Sexual Assault Awareness Month, then you need to be talking about the assault that happened to our ancestors that were put in captivity, put on plantations, forced to work on these plantations, and were forced to have sex in sex farms and breeding farms without any spiritual soul ties to one another, only to produce more bodies to work on plantations. We want to connect the dots to the sexual abuse and the sexual attack that goes on today. It's not a disconnection. It's all interconnected. So we're looking at the fact that there haven't been any intentional ritual to heal and to grieve that rape that happened for so many years and the sexual abuse that happened for so many years and how it hijacked our sexuality. Because we have a very dysfunctional relationship to our sexuality as a people, period. I mean, it really doesn't matter when it comes to the ethnicity or the socioeconomic background, the sexual orientation. I mean, I know it doesn't matter. Classism, nothing matters when it comes to molestation, rape, and incest. It is an equal opportunity, equity reality that has its fair share to go around for everybody. Look at how and why, what are some of the root causes of these things, you know? And there have been some school of thought that said, oh, well, you know, that's been existing from the beginning of time. But then I've heard other historians say, no, that's not true. That's not true, that this was something that became much more explosive and rampant once Westerners and folks from Europe came to other parts and or went to other indigenous lands and began to colonize and rape. And so when we look at the hypocrisy of that truth not being discuss or those dots being connected, along with connecting the dots of the hypocrisy of Earth Day. Earth Day brought to us by Exxon and Mobil. And I say nations, they are these multinational corporations that are nations unto themselves, you know, and then they get to say, and they celebrate Earth, Mother Earth, as they desecrate it, as they rape her. So let's say rape Mother Earth, they rape, and then we were raped and we continue to be raped. The sexual abuse that continues to go on, the plantation that has now become the prison industrial complex plantation, and how the rape continues. Like as we're speaking right now, there are people being sexually raped, abused right now. You know, we often use that word rape to be symbolic of the rape of our culture and our language and the ways of our life. But I'm like, I want a whole space to be specific about the sexual abuse and how it has affected so many aspects of our life. The trauma that occurs for women and men and boys and girls, because they tend, by being in a patriarchal society, we don't talk about the rape that happened to men and boys. And from the beginning, it happened to men and boys. And we have the whole space for that truth, that it did not just happen to women and girls. And we have the whole space for the fact that we have a dysfunctional relationship to our sexuality that is, you know, sexuality equals spirituality. And then there was the severance that took place from the defense mechanism of our ancestors who wanting to protect their children, their offspring. It seemed like the way it played out, and along with the monotheistic belief systems, turned sex into this taboo topic to talk about. Like not knowing how to talk about sex in a healthy way with our children, teaching women that, oh, you're not gonna enjoy it. It's just all this craziness. And then how did that affect the lack of orgasm and having an orgasmic life on every level of life? Of this mediocrity that we go through life. It doesn't have to stay this way. We can't shift things through our practices of going back to the ways of our ancestors and then doing something different, because of course they didn't have it all right because we're in this predicament. By the same token, they didn't have it all wrong either. And we see that from the earth, because we know, going back to connecting the dots between this rape that happened to our ancestors and their bodies and our bodies and to Mother Earth and Mother Earth's body, where they're wanting us to go green and sustain. And I'm like, I was born green. Don't tell me to go green when I was born green. When this is the ways of our ancestors, we always knew that you cannot control or conquer something that sustains you.
That was Boosie Peters-Mon, creator of Woo, Women Healing and Empowering Women. Woo created a beer ritual, which they will perform on the shores of Galveston Island, the birthplace of Juneteenth, this month. We thank producer Jacqueline Baptiste of KPFT Houston.
Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. The sounds of gristle on dry leaves are not like sounds of insults between pedestrians. Those women laughing in the window do not sound like air conditioners on the blink. The river turtle does not breathe like a slithering boa constrictor. The roar of a bull is not like the cackle of a hyena. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. The growl of a sea leopard is not like the teething cry of a baby. The slash of a barracuda is not like the gulp of a leaping whale. The speech of a tiger shark is not like the bark of an eagle fish. The scent of a gardenia is not like the scent of a tangerine. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. Find it. Find it. Find it. Find it. Find it.
That was Jane Cortez. Find Your Own Voice. April is National Poetry Month. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.